Outside, the sky is clear of gulls, and down at the apartment, my mom's is waiting for me with dinner. 6 months earlier, we were sitting in front of the TV, and my mother said, "Well, I think I'm finally over this place." Nilda asks, "Did you move or something?" I shake my head. "Just been working." God, it's been a long, long time. She's on her clothes like magic, making everything neat, making everything fit. There are four other people at the counters, broke-ass-looking niggers with knee socks and croupier's hats and scars snaking up their arms, and they all seem like sleepwalkers compared with her. She shakes her head, grinning. "Your brother," she says. "Rafa." She points her finger at me like my brother always did. I miss him sometimes. She nods. "Me too. He was a good guy to me." I must have disbelief on my face because she finishes shaking out her towels and then stares straight through me. "He treated me the best." Nilda. "He used to sleep with my hair over his face. He used to say it made him feel safe." What else can we say? She finishes her stacking. I hold the door open for her. The locals watch us leave. We walk back through the old neighborhood, slowed down by the bulk of our clothes. London Terrace has changed now that the landfill has shut down. Kicked up rents and mad South Asian people and white folks living in the apartments. But it's our kids you see in the streets and hanging from the porches. Nilda is watching the ground as though she's afraid she might fall. My heart is beating, and I think we could do anything. We could marry. We could drive off to the West Coast. We could start over. It's all possible, but neither of us speaks for a long time, and the moment closes, and we're back in the world we've always known. "Remember the day we met?" she asks. I nod. "You wanted to play baseball." "It was summer," I say. "You were wearing a tank top. You made me put on a shirt before you'd let me be on your team. Do you remember?" "I remember," I say. We never spoke again. A couple of years later, I went away to college, and I don't know where the fuck she went. Alma. You, Junior, have a girlfriend named Alma, who has a long, tender horse neck and a big Dominican ass that seems to exist in a fourth dimension beyond jeans. An ass that could drag the moon out of orbit, an ass she never liked until she met you. Ain't a day that passes that you don't want to press your face against that ass or bite the delicate sliding tendons of her neck. You love how she shivers when you bite, how she fights you with those arms that are so skinny they belong on an after-school special. Alma is a Mason Gross student, one of those Sonic Youth comic book reading alternatinas without whom you might never have lost your virginity. Grew up in Hoboken, part of the Latino community that got its heart burnt out in the 80s, tenements turning to flame. Spent nearly every teenage day on the Lower East Side, thought it would always be home, but then NYU and Columbia both said niet, and she ended up even farther from the city than before. Alma is in a painting phase, and the people she paints are all the color of mold, look like they've just been dredged from the bottom of a lake. Her last painting was of you, slouching against the front door. "Only you're frowning. I had a lousy third-world childhood, and all I got was this attitude." Eyes recognizable. She did give you one huge forearm. "I told you I'd get the muscles in." The past couple of weeks, now that the warm is here, Alma has abandoned black started wearing these nothing dresses made out of what feels like tissue paper. It wouldn't take more than a strong wind to undress her. She says she does it for you. I'm reclaiming my Dominican heritage. Which ain't a complete lie. She's even taking Spanish to better minister to your moms. And when you see her on the street, flaunting, you know exactly what every nigger that walks by is thinking, because you are thinking it too. Alma is slender as a reed, you a steroid-addicted block. Alma loves driving, you books. Alma owns a Saturn, you have no points on your license. Alma's nails are too dirty for cooking, your spaghetti con pollo is the best in the land. You are so very different. She rolls her eyes every time you turn on the news and says she can't stand politics. She won't even call herself Hispanic. She brags to her girls that you're a radical and a real Dominican, even though on the Platano Index you wouldn't even rank, Alma being only the third Latina you've ever really dated. You brag to your boys that she has more albums than any of them do, that she says terrible white girl things while you fuck. She's more adventurous in bed than any girl you've had. On your first date, she asked you if you wanted to come on her tits or her face. And maybe during boy training, you didn't get one of the memos because you were like, neither? And at least once a week, she will kneel on the mattress before you and with one hand pulling at her dark nipples, will play with herself, not letting you touch at all, fingers whisking the soft of her and her face looking desperately, furiously happy. She loves to talk while she's being dirty, too, will whisper, "You like watching, don't you? You like listening to me come." And when she finishes, lets out this long, demolished groan. And only then will she allow you to pull her into an embrace as she wipes her gummy fingers on your chest. Yes, it's an opposites attract sort of thing. It's a great sex sort of thing. It's a no-thinking sort of thing. It's wonderful, wonderful. Until one June day, Alma discovers that you are also fucking this beautiful freshman girl named Lakshmi. Discovers the fucking of Lakshmi because she, Alma, the girlfriend, opens your journal and reads. Oh, she had her suspicions. She waits for you on the stoop, and when you pull up in her Saturn and notice the journal in her hand, your heart plunges through you like a fat bandit through a hangman's trap. You take your time turning off the car. You are overwhelmed by a pelagic sadness. Sadness at being caught. At the incontrovertible knowledge that she will never forgive you. You stare at her incredible legs, and between them, to that even more incredible popola you've loved so inconstantly these past 8 months. Only when she starts walking over in anger do you finally step out. You dance across the lawn, powered by the last fumes of your outrageous sinvergüencería. "Hey, muñeca," you say, prevaricating to the end. When she starts shrieking, you ask her, "Darling, whatever is the matter?" She calls you a cocksucker, a punk motherfucker, a fake-ass Dominican. She claims you have a little penis, no penis, and worst of all, that you like curried pussy. Which really is unfair, you try to say, since Lakshmi is from Guyana, but Alma isn't listening. Instead of lowering your head and copping to it like a man, you pick up the journal as one might hold a baby's beshattered diaper, as one might pinch a recently benighted condom. You glance at the offending passages. Then you look at her and smile a smile your dissembling face will remember until the day you die. "Baby," you say, "baby, this is part of my novel." This is how you lose her.
I don't need no love.
Otra vida, otra vez. He sits on the mattress, the fat spread of his ass popping my fitted sheets from their corners. His clothes are stiff from the cold, and the splatter of dried paint on his pants has frozen into rivets. He smells of bread. He's been talking about the house he wants to buy, how hard it is to find one when you're Latino. When I ask him to stand up so I can fix the bed, he walks over to the window. "So much snow," he says. I nod and wish he would be quiet. Ana Iris is trying to sleep on the other side of the room. She has spent half the night praying for her children back in Samaná, and I know that in the morning she has to work at the fábrica. She moves uneasily, buried beneath comforters, her head beneath a pillow. Even here in the States, she drapes mosquito netting over her bed. "There's a truck trying to turn the corner," he tells me. "I wouldn't want to be that chamaco." "It's a busy street," I say, and it is. Mornings I find the salt and the cut rock that the trucks spill onto the front lawn, little piles of treasure in the snow. "Lie down," I tell him, and he comes to me, slipping under the covers. His clothes are rough, and I wait until it is warm enough under the sheets before I release the buckle to his pants. We shiver together, and he does not touch me until we stop. "Yasmin," he says. His mustache is against my ear, sawing at me. "We had a man die today at the bread factory." He doesn't speak for a moment, as if the silence is the elastic that will bring his next words forward. "Ese tipo fell from the rafters. Hector found him between the conveyors." "Was he a friend?" "This one? I recruited him at a bar. Told him he wouldn't get cheated." "That's too bad," I say. "I hope he doesn't have a family."
"Probably does."
"Did you see him?"
"What do you mean?"
"Did you see him dead?"
"No. I called the manager and he told me not to let anyone near."
He crosses his arms.
"I do that roof work all the time."
"You're a lucky man, Ramon."
"Yes, but what if it had been me?"
"That's a stupid question."
"What would you have done?"
I set my face against him. He has known the wrong women if he expects more. I want to say exactly what your wife's doing in Santo Domingo. Ana Iris mutters in the corner loudly, but she's just pretending, bailing me out of trouble. He goes quiet because he doesn't want to wake her. After a while, he gets up and sits by the window. The snow has started falling again. Radio Wado says this winter will be worse than the last four, maybe the worst in 10 years. I watch him. He's smoking, his fingers tracing the thin bones around his eyes, the slack of skin around his mouth. I wonder who he's thinking about. His wife, Virta, or maybe his child? He has a house in Villajuana. I've seen the photos Virta sent. She looks thin and sad, the dead son at her side. He keeps the pictures in a jar under his bed, very tightly sealed. We fall asleep without kissing. Later I wake up, and so does he. I ask him if he's going back to his place, and he says no. The next time I wake up, he doesn't. In the cold and darkness of this room, he could be almost anybody. I lift his meaty hand. It is heavy and has flour under each nail. Sometimes at night I kiss his knuckles, crinkled as prunes. His hands have tasted of crackers and bread the whole 3 years we've been together. He does not talk to me, or Ana Iris, as he dresses. In his top jacket pocket, he carries a blue disposable razor that has begun to show rust on its sharp lip. He soaps his cheeks and chin, the water cold from the pipes, and then scrapes his face clean, trading stubble for scabs. I watch, my naked chest covered with goosebumps. He stomps downstairs and out of the house, a bit of toothpaste on his teeth. As soon as he leaves, I can hear my housemates complaining about him. "Doesn't he have his own place to sleep?" they'll ask me when I go into the kitchen. And I'll say, "Yes," and smile. From the frosted window, I watch him pull up his hood and hitch the triple layer of shirt, sweater, and coat onto his shoulders. Ana Iris kicks back her covers. "What are you doing?" she asks me. "Nothing," I say. She watches me dress from under the craziness of her hair. "You have to learn to trust your men," she says.
I trust. She kisses my nose, heads downstairs. I comb out my hair, sweep the crumbs and pubic hair from my covers. Anaïdis doesn't think he'll leave me. She thinks he's too settled here, that we've been together too long. He's the sort of man who'll go to the airport but won't be able to get on board, she says. Anaïdis left her own children back on the island, hasn't seen her three boys in nearly 7 years. She understands what has to be sacrificed on a voyage. In the bathroom, I stare into my own eyes. His stubble quivers in beads of water, compass needles. I work 2 blocks away at St. Peter's Hospital. Never late, never leave the laundry room, never leave the heat. I load washers, I load dryers, peel the lint skin from the traps, measure out heaping scoops of crystal detergent. I'm in charge of 4 other workers. I make an American wage, but it's a donkey job. I sort through piles of sheets with glove hands. The dirties are brought down by orderlies, morenas mostly. I never see the sick. They visit me through the stains and marks they leave on the sheets, the alphabet of the sick and dying. A lot of the time, the stains are too deep, and I have to throw these linens in the special hamper. One of the girls from Baitoa tells me she's heard that everything in the hamper gets incinerated. Because of the sida, she whispers. Sometimes the stains are rusty and old, and sometimes the blood smells sharp as rain. You'd think, given the blood we see, that there's a great war going on out in the world. Just the one inside of bodies, the new girl says. My girls are not exactly reliable, but I enjoy working with them. They play music, they feud, they tell me funny stories. And because I don't yell or bully them, they like me. They're young, sent to the States by their parents, the same age I was when I arrived. They see me now, 28, 5 years here, as a veteran, a rock. But back then, in those first days, I was so alone that every day was like eating my own heart. A few of the girls have boyfriends, and they're the ones I'm careful about depending on. They show up late or miss weeks at a time. They move to Nueva York or Union City without warning. When that happens, I have to go to the manager's office. He's a little man, a thin man, a bird-looking man, has no hair on his face, but a thatch grows on his chest and up his neck. I tell him what happened, and he pulls the girl's application and rips it in half, the cleanest of sounds. In less than an hour, one of the other girls has sent a friend to me for an application. The newest girl's called Samantha, and she's a problem. She's dark and heavy-browed and has a mouth like unswept glass. When you least expect it, she cuts you. Walked onto the job after one of the other girls ran off to Delaware. She's been in the States only 6 weeks and can't believe the cold. Twice she's tipped over the detergent barrels, and she has a bad habit of working without gloves and then rubbing her eyes. She tells me that she's been sick, that she's had to move twice, that her housemates have stolen her money. She has the scared, hunted look of the unlucky. Work is work, I tell her, but I loan her enough for her lunches, let her do personal laundry in our machines. I expect her to thank me, but instead she says that I talk like a man. Does it get any better? I hear her ask the others. Just worse, they say. Wait for the freezing rain. She looks over at me, half smiling, uncertain. She's 15, maybe, and too thin to have mothered a child, but she's already shown me the pictures of her fat boy, Manolo. She's waiting for me to answer, me in particular because I'm the veterana, but I turn to the next load. I've tried to explain to her the trick of working hard, but she doesn't seem to care. She cracks her gum and smiles at me like I'm 70. I unfold the next sheet, and like a flower, the blood stains there, no bigger than my hand. Hamper, I say, and Samantha throws it open. I ball the sheet up and toss, slops right in, the loose ends dragged in by the center. 9 hours of smoothing linen, and I am home, eating cold yuca with hot oil, waiting for Ramon to come for me in the car he has borrowed. He has taken me to look at another house.
It's been his dream since he first set foot in the States. And now, with all the jobs he's had and the money he's saved, it's possible. How many get to this point? Only the ones who never swerve, who never make mistakes, who are never unlucky. And that, more or less, is Ramon. He's serious about the house, which means I have to be serious about it, too. Each week we go out into the world and look. He makes an event of it, dressing like he's interviewing for a visa, drives us around the quieter sections of Patterson, where the trees have spread over roofs and garages. It's important, he says, to be careful, and I agree. He takes me with him whenever he can, but even I can tell that I'm not much help. I'm not one for change, I tell him, and I see only what's wrong with the places he wants, and later in the car, he accuses me of sabotaging his dreams, of being dura. Tonight we're supposed to see another. He walks into the kitchen, clapping his chapped hands, but I'm in no mood, and he can tell. He sits down next to me. He puts his hand on my knee. You're not going? I'm sick. How sick? Bad enough. He rubs at his stubble. What if I find the place? You wouldn't want me to make the decision myself. I don't think it will happen. And if it does? You know you'll never move me there. He scowls. He checks the clock. He leaves. Anaïdis is working her second job, so I spend my evening alone, listening to this whole country going cold on the radio. I try to keep still, but by 9 I have the things he stores in my closet spread before me, the things he tells me never to touch, his books and some of his clothes, an old pair of glasses in a cardboard case, and 2 beaten chancletas, hundreds of dead lottery tickets, crimped together in thick wads that fall apart at the touch. Dozens of baseball cards, Dominican players, Guzman, Fernandez, Diaz, swatting balls, winding up, and fielding hard-line drives just beyond the baseline. He has left me some of his dirties to wash, but I haven't had the time, and tonight I lay them out, the yeast still strong on the cuffs of his pants and work shirts. In a box on the top shelf of the closet, he has a stack of Vita's letters, clinched in a fat brown rubber band. Nearly 8 years worth. Each envelope is worn and frail, and I think he's forgotten they're here. I found them a month after he stored his things, right at the start of our relationship. Couldn't resist. And afterward, I wish I had. He claims that he stopped writing her the year before. But that's not true. Every month I drop by his apartment with his laundry and read the new letters she has sent, the ones he stashes under his bed. I know Virta's name, her address. I know she works at a chocolate factory. I know that he hasn't told her about me. The letters have grown beautiful over the years, and now the handwriting has changed as well. Each letter loops down, drooping into the next line like a rudder. Please, please, mi querido husband, tell me what it is. How long did it take before your wife stopped mattering? After reading her letters, I always feel better. I don't think this says good things about me. We are not here for fun, Anaïdis told me the day we met, and I said, yes, you're right, even though I did not want to admit it. Today I say these same things to Samantha, and she looks at me with hatred. This morning, when I arrived at the job, I found her in the bathroom crying, and I wish I could let her rest for an hour, but we don't have those kinds of bosses. I put her on the folding, and now her hands are shaking, and she looks like she's going to cry again. I watch her for a long time, and then I ask her, what's wrong? And she says, what isn't wrong? This, Anaïdis said, is not an easy country. A lot of girls don't make it through their first year. You need to concentrate on work, I tell Samantha. It helps. She nods, her little girl's face vacant. It is probably her son she misses, or the father, or our whole country, which you never think of until it's gone, which you never love until you're no longer there. I squeeze her arm and go upstairs to report in, and when I come back, she's gone. The other girls pretend not to notice. I check the bathroom, find a bunch of crumpled up paper towels on the floor. I smooth them out and put them on the edge of the sink. Even after lunch, I keep expecting her to walk in and say, "Here I am. I just went for a stroll." The truth is, I am lucky to have a friend like Anaïdis. She's like my sister. Most of the people I know in the States have no friends here. They're crowded together in apartments. They're cold. They're lonely. They're worn. I've seen the lines at the phone places, the men who sell stolen card numbers, the cuarto they carry in their pockets. When I first reached the States, I was like that, alone, living over a bar with 9 other women. At night, no one could go to bed because of the screams and the exploding bottles from downstairs. Most of my housemates were fighting with each other over who owed who what or who had stolen money. When I myself had extra, I went to the phones and called my mother just so I could hear the voices of the people in my barrio as they passed the phone from hand to hand, like I was good luck. I was working for Ramon at the time. We weren't going out yet. That wouldn't happen for another 2 years. He had a housekeeping guiso then, mostly in Piscataway. The day we met, he looked at me critically. "Which pueblo are you from?" "Moca." "Mata dictador," he said. And then, a little while later, he asked me which team I supported. "Aguilas," I told him, not really caring. "Licey," he boomed. "The only real team on the island." That was the same voice he used to tell me to swab a toilet or scrub an oven. I didn't like him then. He was too arrogant and too loud, and I took to humming when I heard him discussing fees with the owners of the houses. But at least he didn't try to rape you like many of the other bosses. At least there was that. He kept his eyes and his hands mostly to himself. He had other plans, important plans, he told us, and just watching him, you could believe it. My first months were house cleaning and listening to Ramon argue. My first months were taking long walks through the city and waiting for Sunday to call my mother. During the day, I stood in front of mirrors in those great houses and told myself that I'd done well. And afterward, I would come home and fold up in front of the small television we crowded around, and I believed this was enough. I met Anaïdis after Ramon's business failed. "Not enough ricos around here," he said, without discouragement. Some friends set up the meeting, and I met her at the fish market. Anaïdis was cutting and preparing fish as we spoke. I thought she was a Boricua, but later she told me she was half Boricua, half Dominicana. "The best of the Caribbean and the worst," she said. She had fast, accurate hands, and her fillets were not ragged as were some of the others on the bed of crushed ice. "Can you work at a hospital?" she wanted to know. "I can do anything," I said. "There'll be blood. If you can do that, I can work in a hospital." She was the one who took the first pictures that I mailed home. Weak photos of me grinning, well-dressed and uncertain. One in front of the McDonald's, because I knew my mother would appreciate how American it was. Another one in a bookstore. I'm pretending to read, even though the book is in English. My hair is pinned up, and the skin behind my ears looks pale and underused. I'm so skinny, I look sick. The best picture is of me in front of a building at the university. There are no students, but hundreds of metal folding chairs have been arranged in front of the building for an event, and I'm facing those chairs, and they're facing me, and in the light, my hands are startling on the blue fabric of my dress. 3 nights a week, we look at houses. The houses are in terrible condition. They are homes for ghosts and for cockroaches and for us, los Hispanos. Even so, few people will sell to us. They treat us well enough in person, but in the end, we never hear from them. And the next time Ramon drives by, other people are living there, usually blanquitos, tending the lawn that should have been ours, scaring crows out of our mulberry trees. Today a grandfather, with red tints in his gray hair, tells us he likes us. He served in our country during the Guerra Civil. "Nice people," he says. "Beautiful people." The house is not entirely a ruin, and we're both nervous, Ramon stalks about like a cat searching for a place to whelp. He steps into closets and bangs against walls and spends close to 5 minutes running his finger around the basement's wet seams. He smells the air for a hint of mold. In the bathroom, I flush the toilet while he holds his hand under the full torrent of the shower. We both search the kitchen cabinets for roaches. In the next room, the grandfather calls our references and laughs at something somebody has said. He hangs up and says something to Ramon that I don't understand. With these people, I cannot even rely on their voices. The Blancos will call your mother a puta in the same voice they greet you with. I wait without hoping until Ramon leans close and tells me it looks good. That's wonderful, I say. Still sure Ramon will change his mind. He trusts very little. Out in the car, he starts in, certain that the old man is trying to trick him. Why? Did you see something wrong? They make it look good. That's part of the trick. You watch. In 2 weeks, the roof will start falling in. Won't he fix it? He says he will. But would you trust an old man like that? I'm surprised that Viejo can still get around. We say nothing more. He screws his head down into his shoulders, and the cords in his neck pop out. I know he will yell if I talk. He stops at the house, the tire sliding on the snow. Do you work tonight? I ask. Of course I do. He settles back into the Buick, tired. The windshield is streaked and sooty, and the margins that the wipers cannot reach have a crust of dirt on them. We watch two kids pound a third with snowballs, and I feel Ramon sadden, and I know he's thinking about his son, and right then I want to put my arm around him, tell him it will be fine. Will you be coming by? Depends on how the work goes. Okay, I say. My housemates trade phony smiles over the greasy tablecloth when I tell them about the house. Sounds like you're going to be bien cómoda, Marisol says. No worries for you. None at all. You should be proud. Yes, I say. Later I lie in bed and listen to the trucks outside, their beds rattling with salt and sand. In the middle of the night I wake up and realize that he has not returned, but not until morning am I angry. Anaïdis's bed is made, the netting folded neatly at its foot, a gauze. I hear her gargling in the bathroom. My hands and feet are blue from the cold, and I cannot see through the window for the frost and icicles. When Anaïdis starts praying, I say, please, just not today. She lowers her hands. I dress. He's talking again about the man who fell from the rafters. What would you do if that was me? He asks once more. I would find another man, I tell him. He smiles. Would you? Where would you find one? You have friends, don't you? What man would touch a dead man's novia? I don't know, I said. I wouldn't have to tell anyone. I could find a man the way I found you. They would be able to tell. Even the most bruto would see the death in your eyes. A person doesn't mourn forever. Some do. He kisses me. I bet you would. I'm a hard man to replace. They tell me so at work. How long did you mourn for your son? He stops kissing me. Enriquillo. I mourned him a long time. I'm still missing him. I couldn't tell that by looking at you. You don't look carefully enough. It doesn't show, I don't think. He puts his hand down at his side. You are not a clever woman. I'm just saying it doesn't show. I can see that now, he says. You are not a clever woman. While he sits by the window and smokes, I pull the last letter his wife wrote him out of my purse and open it in front of him. He doesn't know how brazen I can be. One sheet, smelling of violet water. Please, Virta has written neatly in the center of the page. That's all. I smile at Ramon and place the letter back in the envelope. Anaïdis once asked me if I loved him, and I told her about the lights in my old home in the capital, how they flickered, and you never knew if they would go out or not. You put down your things, and you waited, and couldn't do anything really until the lights decided. This, I told her, is how I feel. Here is what the wife looks like. She is small, with enormous hips, and has the grave seriousness of a woman who will be called Doña before she's 40. I suspect if we were in the same life, we would not be friends. I hold up the blue hospital sheets in front of me and close my eyes, but the bloodstains float in the darkness in front of me. Can we save this one with bleach? Samantha asks. She is back, but I don't know for how much longer. I don't know why I don't fire her. Maybe because I want to give her a chance. Maybe because I want to see if she will stay or if she will go. What will this tell me? Very little, I suspect. In the bag at my feet, I have his clothes, and I wash them all together with the hospital things. For a day, he will smell of my job, but I know that bread is stronger than blood. I have not stopped watching for signs that he misses her. You must not think on these things, Anaïdis tells me. Keep them out of your mind. You don't want to go crazy from them. This is how Anaïdis survives here, how she keeps from losing her mind over her children, how in part we all survive here. I've seen a picture of her three sons, three little boys tumbled out in the Jardín Japonés, near a pine tree, smiling, the smallest a saffron blur, trying to shy away from the camera. I listen to her advice, and on my way to and from work, I concentrate on the other sleepwalkers around me, the men who sweep the streets, and those who stand around in the back of restaurants, with uncut hair, smoking cigarettes, the people in suits who stumble from the trains. A good many will stop over at a lover's, and that is all they will think about while they're eating their cold meals at home, while they're in bed with their spouses. I think of my mother, who kept with a married man when I was 7, a man with a handsome beard and craggy cheeks, who was so black that he was called Noche by everyone who knew him. He worked stringing wires for Codetel out in the campo, but he lived in our barrio and had 2 children with a woman he had married in Pedernales. His wife was very pretty, and when I think of Ramon's wife, I see her, in heels, flashing yards of brown leg, a woman warmer than the air around her, una jeva buena. I do not imagine Ramon's wife as uneducated. She watches the telenovelas simply to pass the time. In her letters, she mentions a child she tends, who she loves almost as much as she had loved her own. In the beginning, when Ramon had not been gone long, she believed they could have another son, one like this Victor, her amorcito. He plays baseball like you, Virta wrote. She never mentions Enriquillo. Here, there are calamities without end, but sometimes I can clearly see us in the future, and it is good. We will live in his house, and I will cook for him, and when he leaves food out on the counter, I will call him a zángano. I can see myself watching him shave every morning. And at other times I see us in that house, and I see how one bright day, or a day like this, so cold your mind shifts every time the wind does, he will wake up and decide it's all wrong. He will wash his face and then turn to me. I'm sorry, he'll say. I have to leave now. Samantha comes in sick with the flu. I feel like I'm dying, she says. She drags herself from task to task. She leans against the wall to rest. She doesn't eat anything, and the day after, I have it too. I pass it to Ramon. He calls me a fool for doing so. You think I can take a day off from work? He demands. I say nothing. It will only irritate him. He never stays angry for long. He has too many other things on his mind. On Friday, he comes by to update me on the house. The old man wants to sell to us, he says. He shows me some paperwork that I do not understand. He is excited, but he is also scared. This is something I know, a place I've been. What do you think I should do? His eyes are not watching me. They're looking out the window. I think you should buy yourself a home. You deserve it. He nods. I need to break him down on the price, though. He takes out his cigarette. Do you know how long I've waited for this? To own a house in this country is to begin to live. I tried to bring up Virta, but he kills it, like always. I already told you it's over, he snaps. What else do you want? A maldito corpse? You women never know how to leave things alone. You never know how to let go. That night, Ana Iris and I go to a movie. We cannot understand the English, but we both like the new theater's clean rugs. Blue and pink neon stripes zag across the walls like lightning. We buy a popcorn to share and smuggle in cans of tamarind juice from the bodega. The people around us talk. We talk as well. You're lucky to be getting out, she says. Those cueros are driving me crazy. It's a little early for this, but I say, I'm going to miss you. And she laughs. You're on your way to another life. You won't have time to miss me. Yes, I will. I'll probably be over to visit you every day. You won't have the time. I will if I make time. Are you trying to get rid of me? Of course not, Yasmin. Don't be stupid. It won't be for a while anyway. I remember what Ramon had said over and over again. Anything can happen. We sit quietly for the rest of the movie. I have not asked her what she thinks of my move, and she has not offered her opinion. We respect each other's silences about certain things, the way I never ask if she intends to send for her children someday. I cannot tell what she will do. She has had men, and they too have slept in our room, but she never kept any for long. We walk back from the theater close together, careful of the shiny ice that scars the snow. The neighborhood is not safe. Boys who only know enough Spanish to curse stand together at the street corners and scowl. They cross into traffic without looking, and when we pass them, a fat one says, I eat pussy better than anybody in the world. Cochino, Ana Iris hisses, putting her hand on me. We pass the old apartment where I used to live, the one over the bar, and I stare up at it, trying to remember which window I used to stare out of. Come on, Ana Iris says. It's freezing. Ramon must have told Birta something, because the letters stop. I guess it's true what they say. If you wait long enough, everything changes. As for the house, it takes longer than even I could have imagined. He almost walks away a half dozen times, slams phones, throws his drink against the wall, and I expect it to fall away, not to happen. But then, like a miracle, it does. Look, he says, holding up the paperwork. Look! He is almost pleading. I am truly happy for him. You did it, mi amor. We did it, he says quietly. Now we can begin. Then he puts his head down on the table and cries. In December, we move into the house. It's a half ruin, and only two rooms are habitable. It resembles the first place I lived when I arrived in this country. We don't have heat for the entire winter, and for a month we have to bathe from a bucket. Casa de Campo, I call it in jest, but he doesn't take kindly to any criticism of his niño. Not everyone can own a home, he reminds me. I saved 8 years for this. He works on the house ceaselessly, raiding the abandoned properties on the block for materials. Every floorboard he reclaims, he boasts, is money saved. Despite all the trees, the neighborhood is not easy, and we have to make sure to keep everything locked all the time. For a few weeks, people knock on the door, asking if the house is still for sale. Some of them are couples as hopeful as we must have looked. Ramon slams the door on them, as if afraid that they might haul him back to where they are. But when it's me, I let them down softly. It's not, I say. Good luck with your search. This is what I know. People's hopes go on forever. The hospital begins to build another wing. 3 days after the cranes surround our building, as if in prayer, Samantha pulls me aside. Winter has dried her out, left her with reptile hands and lips so chapped they look like they might at any moment split. I need a loan, she whispers. My mother's sick. It's always the mother. I turn to go. Please, she begs. We're from the same country. This is true. We are. Someone must have helped you sometime. Also true. The next day I give her $800. It is half my savings. Remember this.
I will, she says.
She is so happy. Happier than I was when we moved into the house. I wish I could be as free. She sings for the rest of the shift. Songs from when I was younger. Adamo and that lot. But she still is Samantha. Before we punch out, she tells me, don't wear so much lipstick. You have big enough lips as it is.
Ana Iris laughs.
That girl said that to you?
Yes, she did.
Qué desgraciada, she says, not without admiration. At the end of the week, Samantha doesn't return to work. I ask around, but no one knows where she lives. I don't remember her saying anything significant on her last day. She walked out as quietly as ever, drifting down towards the center of town, where she could catch her bus. I pray for her. I remember my own first year, how desperately I wanted to return home, how often I cried. I pray she stays like I did. A week. I wait a week, and then I let her go. The girl who replaces her is quiet and fat and works without stopping or complaint. Sometimes, when I am in one of my moods, I imagine Samantha back home with her people, back home where it is warm, saying, I would never go back, not for anything, not for anyone. Some nights, when Ramon is working on the plumbing or sanding the floors, I read the old letters and sip the rum we store under the kitchen sink and think, of course, of her, the one from the other life. I am pregnant when the next letter finally arrives, sent from Ramon's old place to our new home. I pull it from the stack of mail and stare at it. My heart is beating like it's lonely, like there's nothing else inside of me. I want to open it, but I call Ana Iris instead. We haven't spoken in a long time. I stare out at the bird-filled hedges while the phone rings. I want to go out for a walk, I tell her. The buds are breaking through the tips of the branches. When I step into the old place, she kisses me and sits me down at the kitchen table. Only two of the housemates I know. The rest have moved on or gone home. There are new girls from the island. They shuffle in and out, barely look at me, exhausted by the promises they've made. I want to advise them. No promises can survive that sea. I am showing, and Ana Iris is thin and worn. Her hair has not been cut in months. The split ends rise out of her thick strands like a second head of hair. She can still smile, though. So brightly it is a wonder that she doesn't set something alight. A woman is singing a bachata somewhere upstairs, and her voice in the air reminds me of the size of this house, how high the ceilings are. Here, Ana Iris says, handing me a scarf. Let's go for a walk. I hold the letter in my hands. The day is the color of pigeons. Our feet crush the bits of snow that lie scattered here and there, crusted over with gravel and dust. We wait for the mash of cars to slow at the light, and then we scuttle into the park. Our first months, Ramon and I were in this park daily. Just to wind down after work, he said, but I painted my nails red every time. I remember the day before we first made love, how I already knew it would happen. He had only just told me about his wife and about his son. I was mulling over the information, saying nothing, letting my feet guide us. We met a group of boys playing baseball, and he bullied the bat from them, cut at the air with it, sent the boys out deep. I thought he would embarrass himself, so I stood back, ready to pat his arm when he fell or when the ball dropped at his feet, but he connected with a sharp crack of the aluminum bat and sent the ball out beyond the children with an easy motion of his upper body. The children threw their hands up and yelled, and he smiled at me over their heads. We walked the length of the park without talking, and then we head back across the highway toward downtown. She's writing again, I say, but Ana Iris interrupts me. I've been calling my children, she says. She points out the man across from the courthouse, who sells her stolen call-in card numbers. They've gotten so much older, she tells me, that it's hard for me to recognize their voices. We have to sit down after a while so that I can hold her hand and she can cry. I should say something, but I don't know where a person can start. She will bring them or she will go. That much has changed. It gets cold. We go home. We embrace at the door for what feels like an hour. That night, I give Ramon the letter, and I try to smile while he reads it. Flaca. Your left eye used to drift when you were tired or upset. It's looking for something, you used to say. In those days we saw each other, it fluttered and rolled, and you had to put your finger over to stop it. You were doing this when I woke up and found you on the edge of my chair. You were still in your teacher's gear, but your jacket was off, and enough buttons were open on your blouse to show me the black bra I'd bought you and the freckles on your chest. We didn't know it was the last days, but we should have. I just got here, you said, and I looked out where you'd parked your Civic. Go roll up them windows. I'm not going to be here long. Someone's going to steal it. I'm almost ready to go. You stayed in your chair, and I knew better than to move closer. You had an elaborate system that you thought would keep us out of bed. You sat on the other side of the room. You didn't let me crack your knuckles. You never stayed more than 15 minutes. It never really worked, did it? I brought you guys dinner, you said. I was making lasagna for my class, so I brought the leftovers. My room is hot and small, overrun by books. You never wanted to be in here. It's like being inside of a sock, you said. And any time the boys were away, we slept in the living room, out on the rug. Your long hair was making you sweat, and finally you took your hand away from your eye. You hadn't stopped talking. Today, I was given a new student. Her mother told me to be careful with her, because she had the sight. The sight? You nod. I asked the señora if the sight helped her in school. She said, not really, but it's helped me with the numbers a few times. I'm supposed to laugh, but I stare outside, where a mitten-shaped leaf had stuck to your windshield. You stand beside me. When I saw you, first in our Joyce class and then at the gym, I knew I'd call you Flaca. If you'd been Dominican, my family would have worried about you, brought plates of food to my door. Heaps of plátano and yuca, smothered in liver or queso frito. Flaca. Even though your name was Veronica. Veronica Hardrada. The boys will be home soon, I say. Maybe you should roll up your windows. I'm going now, you say, and put your hand back over your eye. It wasn't supposed to get serious between us. I can't see us getting married or nothing, and you nodded your head and said you understood. Then we fucked so we could pretend that nothing hurtful had just happened. This was like our fifth time together, and you got dressed in a black sheath and a pair of Mexican sandals, and you said I could call you when I wanted, but that you wouldn't call me. You have to decide where and when, you said. If you leave it up to me, I'll want to see you every day. At least you were honest, which is more than I can say for me. Weekdays I never called you, didn't even miss you. I had the boys and my job at Transactions Press to keep me busy. But Friday and Saturday nights, when I didn't meet anybody at the clubs, I called. We talked until the silences were long, until finally you asked, "Do you want to see me?" I'd say yes, and while I waited for you, I'd tell the boys, "It's just sex, you know, Nothing at all. And you'd come with a change of clothes and a pan so you could make us breakfast, maybe cookies you'd bake for your class. The boys would find you in the kitchen the next morning in one of my shirts, and at first they didn't complain because they guessed you would just go away. And by the time they started saying something, it was late, wasn't it? I remember the boys keeping an eye on me. They figured 2 years ain't no small thing, even though the entire time I never claimed you. But what was nuts was that I felt fine. I felt like summer had taken me over. I told the boys this was the best decision I'd ever made. You can't be fucking with white girls all your life. In some groups, that was more than a given. In our group, it was not. In that Joyce class, you never spoke, but I did, all the time. And once you looked at me, and I looked at you, and you turned so red, even the professor noticed. You were white trash from outside of Patterson, and it showed in your no-fashion sense, and you dated niggers a lot. I said you had a thing about us, and you said, angry, no, I do not. But you sorta did. You were the white girl who danced bachata, who pledged the SLUs, who'd gone to Santo Domingo 3 times already. I remember you used to offer me rides home in your Civic. I remember the 3rd time I accepted. Our hands touched in between our seats. You tried to talk to me in Spanish, and I told you to stop. We're on speaking terms today. I say, maybe we should go hang out with the boys, and you shake your head. I want to spend time with you, you say. If we're still good, next week maybe. That's the most we can hope for. Nothing thrown, nothing said we might remember for years. You watch me while you put a brush through your hair. Each strand that breaks is as long as my arm. You don't want to let go, but don't want to be hurt either. It's not a great place to be. But what can I tell you? We drive up to Montclair, almost alone on the parkway. Everything's quiet and dark, and the trees shine from yesterday's rain. At one point, just south of the oranges, the parkway passes through a cemetery, thousands of gravestones and cenotaphs on both sides. Imagine, you say, pointing to the nearest home, if you had to live in that place. The dreams you'd have, I say. You nod. The nightmares. We park across from the map dealer and go to our bookstore. Despite the proximity of the college, we're the only customers, us and a 3-legged cat. You sit yourself down in an aisle and start searching through the boxes. The cat goes right for you. I flip through the histories. You're the only person I've ever met who can stand a bookstore as long as I can. A smarty pants, the kind you don't find every day. When I come back to you again, you have kicked off your shoes and are picking at the running calluses on your feet, reading a children's book. I put my arms around your shoulders. Flaca, I say. Your hair drifts up and clings to my stubble. I don't shave often enough for anybody. This can work, you say. We just have to let it. That last summer, you wanted to go somewhere, so I took us out to Spruce Run. We'd both been there as children. You could remember the years, even the months of your visit, but the closest I came was back when I was young. Look at the Queen Anne's lace, you said. You were leaning out the window into the night air, and I had my hand on your back just in case. We were both drunk, and you had nothing but garters and stockings on under your skirt, and you put my hand between your legs. What did your family do here, you asked. I looked at the night water. We had barbecues, Dominican barbecues. My pops didn't know how to, but he insisted. He would cook up this red sauce that he'd splatter on chuletas, and then he'd invite complete strangers over to eat. It was terrible. I wore an eye patch when I was a kid, you said. Maybe we met out here and fell in love over bad barbecue. I doubt it, I said. I'm just saying, Junior. Maybe 5,000 years ago we were together. 5,000 years ago, I was in Denmark.